from GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. You know, the Underground Railroad was not a real railroad. There were no chugging engines, there were no steel tracks, but there are both of those things in author Colson Whitehead's latest novel. In his book, many historical details about that era are reimagined, and the route to freedom begins in Georgia. The Underground Railroad has won over the attention of critics, Oprah's Book Club, and the National Book Awards, and there's even talk about adapting it into a short-run television series. Colson Whitehead is in Atlanta tomorrow night at the Carter Center, and he joins me now. Good morning.
Hey, howdy.
It's good to have you. You know, the last book I read of yours was about flesh-eating zombies, so imagine my surprise to go the other way
and
still find a dystopian America.
Yeah, well, you know, I try to mix it up from book to book. So Zone One, the book about zombies, came out a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And that was sort of depressing. Everyone's dead. And then my last book was a humor book about the World Series of Poker. So I seem to vacillate between being horribly pessimistic and then kind of optimistic.
Well, I'm going to try to get through this whole interview and reveal no spoilers, but I wonder what you brought with you from that the world of zombies that you imagined to this one, because we're talking about two relatively imagined landscapes.
Sure, but you know there is overlap. You know, in a apocalyptic story, a book or a film, you have survivors and they're trying to get to the last human settlements. Without that hope that there's a place of refuge, a place of safety, what's the point of going on? And, you know, there are always setbacks, and you get to a new place, and things fall apart. But you hope that over the next ridge, over the next hill, there's a place of safety. And, you know, and that's the structure of a slave narrative. You're going from refuge to refuge, hoping to get north. And in the midst of the hell you've been born into, you have to have that hope that there is safety in New York, Massachusetts, Canada, and that hope animates your journey.
I want to listen to actually Laura Smalley. She was born in slavery on a plantation in Texas, and she did an oral history interview in 1941 in which she's talking about watching one of the older women on her plantation being whipped while her hands and legs are tied around a peach tree. It's a bit difficult to understand the audio, but take a listen.
Well, she couldn't do nothing but just kick her feet, you know, just kick her feet. But it just had her clothes all down to her waist, you know. Well, he whipped her so then at night they had to grease her back. Grease her back. I don't know what kind of grease they had, but they sure grease her back. Late that evening, they give her dinner. Late that evening, she said, whoop so bad then, you know, she didn't want to eat, you know. If you whoop you half a day, you ain't want to eat.
So what slave narratives did you consult? Because you clearly did a lot of research, even though the places are not entirely based on historic detail, but what slave narratives did you read?
Yeah, you know, I was inspired by the more famous ones I read in college. You know, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Jacobs. Harriet Jacobs was a woman who ran away from her master when she, hit teenage years and became an object of sexual desire, and hid in an attic for 7 years, waiting for a passage outside of North Carolina. So that is definitely an inspiring chorus story in my book. And then, you know, I'm not sure if that clip you just you played was from the WPA collection from the 1930s. But in the Great Depression, the Works Progress Administration sent out writers to interview former slaves, people who had been kids or teenagers at the time of the Civil War. And there are hundreds of these oral accounts of people's lives, and some of them are just about farming, the very mundane. Some of them are about master-slave relationships, and you know, and together they present a huge portrait of slave life: small farms, big plantations, and it allowed me the freedom to come up with my own plantation for the book.
I read that you actually got the idea for this. First thought to yourself, gee, what if the Underground Railroad were an actual railroad in 2001, but waited 15 years to write it? Why?
Well, I knew when I had the idea that I wasn't ready. I thought you know, I was 30, and I thought if I have more life experience, if I had some more books under my belt, I might be able to, you know, to tackle the idea and do the justice that it deserved. So whenever I finished a book, I would put out my notes and think, am I ready? And then realize I wasn't.
What made this book so difficult?
Slavery. You know, I mean, you know, it's a hard topic to wrap your head around. You know, I think we have one idea of how bad it was. And then once you go into the research and the oral testimony, you realize it's even much, much worse than you imagined. And it had to be. How do you keep millions of people from running away from the plantation? You instill fear. You torture them. You mentally destroy them. And so I had to wait till I was ready and capable of doing the story justice.
But you also said you didn't want to write the novel of Southern black misery. So you read all this stuff about the horrors of slavery, which, as you say, are beyond imagining. But you didn't want to make the book miserable.
Well, I think, you know, that's a quote about how I feel about certain kinds of stereotypical narratives. And so, you know, when I started, I was a very self-conscious person, and I didn't want to write, when I started writing in the 90s, I didn't want to write the Gen X novel of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I didn't want to write that autobiographical first novel. That seemed very obvious. And being from New York, I couldn't relate to, you know, certain Southern novels that were outside of my experience. And so, you know, I've always tried to tackle subjects from a different perspective. And so my first book was about social uplift using the metaphor of elevators. And then this novel hopefully gets to a deeper truth about race and slavery and American history. But of course, the vehicle is a, you know, the childish idea that the Underground Railroad is a real thing. And so I'm always coming at things from a different perspective, and hopefully, you know, that allows people to see things from a different angle.
I'm speaking with Colson Whitehead. He's author of the book The Underground Railroad, and he reimagines that route that carried perhaps 100,000 slaves or more. I mean, the book felt to me, I'm struggling because I don't want to give away any spoilers, but it felt to me almost as one of those almost Greek odysseys. And in every case, when you went to a different state and what you were describing was, it kind of came upon me slow how different it was from what really happened. That I have to say, it was pretty successful at making me rethink a story that I knew really, really well. How did you decide on the character of each of these states? Because they start in Georgia, they go through South Carolina, and they go through, I mean, Tennessee especially, very, very different. How did you make those choices?
Yeah, well, you know, I was thinking about it in the back of my head, you know, for many, many years. And, without going too much into it, you know, I was borrowing a structure from the Odyssey, from Gulliver's Travels, Pilgrim's Progress, you know, all those sort of older stories where a voyager is tested island to island, state to state, by a series of allegorical trials, and so the book is being rebooted every 60 pages as we go to a different state. And there's a different sort of alternative America, an America that might have been. And, you know, and I think for many years, the states were vastly different. One took place in the future. Another was a sort of blasted wasteland. And then as I was trying to figure out how to use my fantastic effects in the book, it seemed just telling it straight in the language and technology of 1850 and keeping Core's experience foregrounded would be the most efficient way of weaving in all these sort of deformations of reality that are in the book.
There's one part, and I wanted to read this quote from it, where you say, quote, "The conflict in Europe was terrible and violent," she told her sailor, "but she took exception to the name, the Great War. The Great War had always been between the white and the black. It would always be." So you also move World War I to the time frame of the mid-19th century. Why?
In order to enlarge the conversation of what has changed and what hasn't changed in terms of race in America. I mean, yeah, that section is a flash forward. And so one of the people who is a young child in 1850 grows yeah. up and has a, you know, a different sort of life. But by, you know, once I make the decision to make the Underground Railroad literal, I'm freed from reality. And my rule was, I'm not going to stick to the facts, but I'm going to stick to the truth. And the truth of race in America is that oppression doesn't end with the end of the Civil War. It doesn't end with Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And it doesn't end with a black president. It's a continuing struggle between the races, between the white and the black, and everybody to come to a better understanding than we've had for centuries.
I have to ask you about this thing I read in the acknowledgments, because you wrote, David Bowie is in every book, and I always put on Purple Rain and Daydream Nation when I write the final pages. I mean, is that literal? Do you really listen to those albums while you're writing?
Well, yeah. I mean, I you know, I'm from New York, and there's always noise, and so that's, you know, I don't write in the silent room. I have a playlist of 2,000 songs, and
it's like your writing playlist.
Yeah, and, you know, it goes from Fatboy Slim, The Public Enemy, to Peggy Lee, to The Cramps, and it keeps me company. You know, I grew up in New York. There's always noise. There's always some siren. Somebody screaming upstairs, and so I'm used to, you know, having that company. And whenever I get to the final page, like the last day of work in that final draft, or that first draft, I put on Purple Rain, Song Keeps State of the Nation, and I know that I've finally made it through to the other side. I wasn't hit by a bus while I was writing. I only have a few more hours of work, and you know, those albums lift me up.
Okay, so let me get back to the actual novel itself. I just had to take that little... Although, if you want to send me the playlist of 2,000 songs, I would totally listen to that, and maybe I'll become a famous novelist. You also talked about the difference over the course of 15 years of becoming a parent possibly made it possible for you to write this book, and so much of this book is based on parenthood and the loss of a child, including the final spoiler, which I will not in any way, shape, or form reveal. But what changed for you when you became a parent?
Well, I think, you know, when you think about slavery or contemplate it, it's one thing, you know, like when you see Roots when you're 8, like I was. Another thing when you study it in college. And then when you're older and if you have kids, you know, at least for me, I was awakened, you know, to a new empathy, you know, in becoming a parent, and you realize what it is to see your wife, your son, your daughter whipped in front of you. You realize what it is to see a relative sold down south to a harsher system, a harsher plantation. And, for me, you know, when I had the idea at 30, I wasn't emotionally ready, I think, to deal with the material. And, you know, I'm glad I waited 16 years to become a more mature and, you know, hopefully wiser person. I think if you stick at something over the years, you get better. So I've become a better writer. And if you, and hopefully we're all more mature than we were 15 years ago. That's, you know, that's one of my small hopes, is that we, you know, all of us get better with age, hopefully.
You may not be able to make that assumption, but you may, I mean, if I'm going to go by what you said earlier, then your next book is going to be a humor book about cats, right? I mean, the next one's going to be funny?
Some cats, some clowns, you know.
Wait, don't say clowns. We're having problems with clowns in the South.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think like most people, I have, you know, pessimistic, optimistic, trajectories, my personality, and you know, you keep writing books, and you get to address different interests. And I like post-apocalyptic fiction. I like dealing with history, and so you keep working, you get to tackle different things.
Does it make it sustainable, though? I mean, we've got about 30 seconds left. Does it make it more sustainable that you go from one serious to more one lighthearted one?
It seems to work, and you know, if you're dealing with terrible material, that's really hard. Having a book that's full of jokes or is lighthearted definitely takes the edge off.
That is author Colson Whitehead. He is author of the book The Underground Railroad, among with many others. You can catch him tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at the Carter Center in Atlanta. He'll read passages from his novel and sign copies of his book. Colson, it's a pleasure.